You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, TFM's local watering hole, and I'm just one of your hosts, Matthew Rushing. So excited to be coming at you here live from Edoras. Man, it has been rebuilt. It looks fantastic. And with me, as she is every single episode, the one and only Shield Maiden, Christy Morris.
Oh, thank you so much. Maybe also known as Valkyrie in other circles. It's a high honor for sure. A lot of training involved.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, you know, they don't just pass out the Shield Maiden name to anybody.
Yeah.
You know, that's a title you got to earn. Mm-hmm. So, well, we're about to earn our titles here as we dive into the brand new film, Lord of the Rings, The War of the Rohirrim. But before we do that, a quick reminder, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Please do find us and subscribe wherever you're listening. Also, you know, if you're like on Apple Podcasts, give us a star rating review. It's been a really long time since we've had one of those, and those things really do help. I know all podcasts say that, but we would really appreciate you doing that for us. Also, share us with your friends over on social media. In fact, you can follow us at the 602 Club on X, Twitter. You can also find us on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. Find the entire network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, as well as join the Babel Conference, a listeners-only discussion group where you can talk to listeners from all over the world. And, of course, we've got our website at trek.fm where you can see all that's happening. Plus, if you like the content that we've got coming to you, go over to Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM and support us so we can keep all of these shows coming to you. So, Christy, I had to ask you about this. Obviously, the last thing that we got from Peter Jackson and company with The Lord of the Rings was the Hobbit trilogy. And so this meant there was going to be more Lord of the Rings coming out. And so first, we've had more Lord of the Rings recently with The Rings of Power. And so I just kind of wanted to ask you with that, you know, have you been enjoying that show? Have you been watching that show? And did that make you less excited or more excited for this movie?
So I will say I haven't watched Rings of Power. And although I have seen all the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit trilogies, I have never read the books, but loved all of the movies. So definitely came into this a Lord of the Rings fan, but maybe not as massive of a fan as people that have been, you know, readers of the books and lifelong, you know, exciters of all things Tolkien. But what about you? Had you either read books or watched Rings of Power?
Absolutely. I mean, I have read many of the Tolkien books, not just the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit.
And the appendices.
And the appendices.
Oh, there you go.
You know, I've read, many of the things, not all of the things that Christopher Tolkien had edited that his father had been working on, and he finished, of course, the Silmarillion as well. And so, you know, relatively steeped in the world of Tolkien and the Lord of the Rings and Middle Earth. My wife and I, we did watch the first season of Rings of Power, and unfortunately for us, it does not work at all, and part of that is because it is a Lord of the Rings skin suit. It is something that's pretending to be Lord of the Rings, if you ask me, but it doesn't have really anything to do with the series other than the names. It's like Lord of the Rings in name only. It just nothing feels right or real in it, and too much of it feels driven by kind of agenda-driven storytelling that is rife in so many of the fantasy series that we get, especially they did the same thing with Wheel of Time, honestly. And so, Rings of Power, just not for us. It did not work at all. I honestly, it's one of those shows where we barely finished the first season, and we're like, even if there's a second season coming out, I have no desire to watch that. And so
that's sad.
Yeah, absolutely. I was absolutely frustrated that that was the case because, obviously Amazon was spending tons of money to bring this to life, and I was really hoping that it would be good, and it just really wasn't for me. And I think if you want that story, read The Fall of Numenor by J.R.R. Tolkien. And I don't believe that one was actually edited by his son. I think he had died at that point. I can't remember. And it's downstairs, so I can't look it up on the shelf. But so I'm interested then, like, coming into this, though, the idea that the people who gave us the Lord of the Rings films, as well as the Hobbit trilogy, were you then excited coming into this, knowing that they were going to be kind of responsible now for bringing more Lord of the Rings stories into the world?
I was. It was interesting. I actually saw the preview for this in the theater before another movie I went to see, and initially wasn't sure what it was, and then saw the title, War of the Rohirrim, and, seeing Tolkien's name on it as an executive producer, and several other people, like Eowyn, the actress that voiced her, being credited, and said, oh, okay, well, then that lends more gravitas to it for me. That it's something that is legitimately connected to the Lord of the Rings, even if I'm not sure how, and is in a totally different style, being anime rather than live action.
Yes. Yeah.
So definitely the trailer got me.
100%. I mean, in that sense, I right there with you on that. Knowing that this was coming from them, and, you go back and listen to our Lord of the Rings episodes and our Hobbit episodes that we did here. And of course, at this point, those were years ago now. In fact, the Lord of the Rings episodes, I think, were some of the first that we did, I believe. Those were, in the 20s or 30s when it comes to episode numbers. But yeah, go back and check those out. You can hear our conversations about that. But, I really enjoyed, actually, the work that they did. I thought that they did a great job with bringing the films to life. And yes, I acknowledge that there are places where, of course, those films deviate from the source material. But those are always, and to me, those were places where I really felt that it made sense and it worked. And I could understand why they were doing it because of, bringing something to screen and all. And so this, I was definitely glad that this, these production people were going to be bringing, more Lord of the Rings stories, and then knowing that they were mining the appendices here for more stories was also really an interesting thing for me. And so definitely glad to see that coming. And one of the interesting things about this too, and we've seen this actually be the case with something like Marvel, but I don't know if you knew this, one of the main reasons for them kind of pushing the idea of doing a film again was the fact that if they didn't, they would lose the film rights to Tolkien's novels, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. And so a lot like Marvel, owned by Sony, who also had to keep making Spider-Man-related movies or material so they could keep that license, this being the case. And so I found that to be really interesting because, I don't always know if, we've got to make a film or else we lose the license, being the best reason to actually make a movie.
Right. It's almost like the cash grab movie where they said, we did a, John Wick 1, we might as well do 3 more, even though that wasn't the case. It ended up all being awesome.
Yes.
But, you know, we've seen that before where people let the situation dictate more content rather than having good content.
Right.
So.
Yes. 100%. No, I think you've nailed that. And so, you know, in some ways, I do think that that did leave me slightly trepidatious when I had read that that was kind of one of their impetuses for making the movie. But I was definitely excited just to see it in the first place and see, you know, what they were going to come up with here. And I didn't even have this on the outline, but you know, when you watched Lord of the Rings, what was your kind of favorite group of people? Was it Gondor, Rohan? Was it the hobbits? Was it the elves? Which for you were a people that you thought, oh, I'd like to explore that more?
It was definitely the elves for me.
Okay.
And, you know, it was because of their lifespan, the way that they had this option where they could take someone away to be safe somewhere else, and also just that they seemed to constantly be aglow somehow. You know, they kind of had this aura around them that made them look a little glowy. And then obviously the whole relationship with Aragorn was just time-stopping love.
Well, I think the glow was just because, you know, they had Cate Blanchett playing an elf, and then they had
Liv Tyler
exactly playing another one, and so I mean those women just kind of glow in general. So,
they have perfect skin, you know, they glow.
It's like perfection there. So yeah.
But yeah, so I've always kind of had an affinity for the elves and thought that their background was so fascinating, and the necklace that she had and mm-hmm. all those kind of things.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me coming into this too, I always really enjoyed, the Rohirrim and Rohan as a group of people. I found them to kind of be fascinating. I love the way that Tolkien kind of was pulling from his love of you know, kind of like Viking style people. Mm-hmm. It's almost like they were kind of like the cowboys of the Lord of the Rings, you know, with their love of horses too and all that. So all of that really I thought was great. And so the idea of them then exploring more of them here in this movie was exciting to me. So I got to ask you, you know, obviously this is different than all of the other movies that they have produced, which have been in live action. And in this, not only was it going to be an animated movie, but they chose to do this in the animation style of anime. And so, one, how did you feel about that coming into the movie? And did it work for you? And what did you think of the animation? And I guess maybe, you know, have you enjoyed anime already, you know, beyond this movie? Or is it something you haven't really spent a lot of time with?
That's the funny thing, actually. I've never been an anime person. It has to really impress me. I will say Michael got me to watch a little bit of Attack on Titan, and I was incredibly impressed. I could not stick with it because it was just constant despair, and that's not good for my mental health. But the animation on that was just, I mean, it's the model, I think, for everyone in the future trying to do anime. And so I felt that they were going for a similar style here with the way it was shot, with the background and then having slightly different anime in the foreground moving on top of that background. But I was really impressed by the style with this movie. I wasn't sure at first if I would like it, but the way that it was done was so crisp, for one thing. And then combined with the voice talent and the music, it just all worked very well together in that sense. I think it was beautiful to look at, and I saw it in Dolby.
Okay, Yes, that's, man, you're so lucky too, because I wanted to see it in Dolby, but the only times that it was playing in Dolby were during the afternoon, because they were using the evening showings for that new dumb, stupid Marvel Spider-Man universe movie, Kraven the Hunter, which has gotten such terrible reviews. And so I was like really frustrated because I didn't get a chance to see this in Dolby because I couldn't make it in the afternoon.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so, yeah, I might actually have to go back and see if I could find and watch it in Dolby. But, you know, I'm not the world's biggest anime fan, but I have seen some, you know, very important anime movies like Ghost in the Shell and those type of films that have really defined the genre in that way. Of course, I've also seen a bunch of the Miyazaki films as well, like Ponyo and mm-hmm. Howl's Moving Castle and all of those type of films as well. So I have some familiarity with this animation style. I have friends who keep telling me I need to watch Arcane, and I just haven't had a chance to watch it yet over on Netflix. I want to. It's not that I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I just haven't had the opportunity yet, and I will. So, you know. But I remember, you know, seeing the fact that this was going to come out in an anime style and that they were going to be doing an animated film. And for me, I was excited about that. You know, I'm a huge fan of animation. I think animation is a completely legitimate genre, and there are some times where films should only be in animation. I mean, don't get me started on the fact that I think it's ridiculous that all of these studios keep remaking their animated, their perfect animated films into live action. I think it denigrates the fact that animation is a completely valid genre, and sometimes it's just legitimately the best way to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, I could go on for hours how dumb I think it is that we keep doing this, and how I think ridiculous it is that the populace keeps falling for this, because it's just literally the same movie, and like The Lion King, it's literally just another animated movie, and
yeah.
It's like, I don't, anyway.
And it's not even live action. But, it's
no, exactly.
3D animation.
It's just another form of animation. Yes. It's computer animation.
Those are not real lions.
Hand drawn animation. Yes. 100%. 100%. So,
anyway.
But, you know, the beauty of this was I thought that this could really work. And what I was seeing with the previews and just the artwork itself and everything, it was working for me. And I thought it was really beautifully done. And just in the film, you know, I thought for the most part, it was gorgeous. There are some shots of this film, especially like at the opening where they're traveling over the mountains. It's like, I can't tell if that's real or animation.
Yeah.
It was so well done.
The scenery is
and
beautiful.
So there were many, yes. And I loved the character work and everything. Now, I will say that there were a couple of places where I felt like the camera placement for the animated shot was kind of strange. Like at the very end of the movie, where we're kind of like, you can't see Hera's horse's legs. And so it's just this weird shot where it's like, I wish they had kind of pulled out and had the whole horse in the shot. And
oh,
I
instead think of it just, would just bouncing been a without shot legs.
Choice. Yeah, exactly. It was just strange. Mm. So there were a couple places like that where some of those things happened. But on a whole, I thought the animation was gorgeous. I thought it worked for the storytelling. You know, I think, you know, it goes all the way back to the fact that Rankin Bass doing like the Hobbit animated film all the way back in the day. You know, Lord of the Rings has a good history with animation. And I think Tolkien's storytelling actually lends itself to utilizing animation because of some of the grandness of things. And it's a little bit easier there to do in that sense. So, no, I thought it was great. I, for the most part, it truly, I think, felt like it kind of added to the story instead of subtracted to the story, and that they did a great job. So, you mentioned earlier, you know, we have Miranda Otto back as our narrator for the film. We have a very familiar voice narrating this film, and it's Eowyn, who is telling the story of this character. And so how did that work for you as the motif of the story of having this be something as almost, it almost feels like Eowyn telling a story to her children at some point after the Lord of the Rings series. Did it work for you? Was that a good choice to use her as our in to this story?
Yes, definitely. I think you needed that to, again, tie it to the original material and make it feel familiar and important for Lord of the Rings fans to see. And I love how, too, if you read some background on the movie, that it was also specifically chosen for her to do it and to narrate and not just have it be a movie without a narrator, because in cultures like Viking culture, oral tradition was the way of preserving culture. And so that's why, again, this is looped in, is it's another way that legitimizes the form that they tried to tell the story in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because yes, I mean, when you look at cultures, especially like Viking culture, the storytelling, the oral storytelling tradition was huge. And especially in cultures where, you know, you didn't have people who learned to read and write as we do now all the time.
Mm-hmm. And in song form.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I love that. I think it's so cool that they did that. And also, in many ways, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, begin with a narration from Galadriel, mm-hmm. as if she's telling you the story. And she, you know, she tells you, she narrates the whole beginning of what happened in the past, and has brought us to the place that we're at. And so I just, love that they decided to do that here, because I think it does really work. And so, and then having it be like you mentioned, having it be Eowyn, it's a character we know. It's a character we're familiar with, and then she helps us introduce us to this world that we kind of know, and yet at the same time, is different, because it's almost 200 years before the time that we've been in the Lord of the Rings world. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really good. So what did one of the most interesting things about one of the most interesting things here about this story, just talking about the fact that Eowyn, you know, does the narration. One of the things that she says is that this is not a story that you would be told, because this unnamed daughter from the appendices of the Lord of the Rings is given a much bigger role. In the book, she's not mentioned other than being the daughter of Helm and someone that Wolf is proposed to marry by his father.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you feel about them kind of taking this character then and, you know, making her a massive part of this story, you know, kind of giving her the name Hera based on Old English, and you know, they actually based her character off Ethelred, who is a famous historical female leader from you know, the time of the Vikings, and was a ruler. And so did this all kind of work for you, for them to kind of take this character and make her basically the linchpin then of this story?
Yes. And it's a couple of reasons why it worked for me. For one, I love that they incorporated into the storytelling about the character, similarly to how times of war happened in America, she said, when all the men died in battle, the Shield Maidens had to step up and defend Rohan. And so I loved that connection of, you know, just like in World War II and other wars, that when all of the men were taken to go and be soldiers and women were left behind, they were the ones that were working in the factories and ensuring that they had, you know, an income and food on the table and felt like they were also part of the effort. So I liked that aspect. And then also, I think that there was a danger here, and maybe it's one of the criticisms of this movie, of her being almost like a Mary Sue, where she went from being the unnamed daughter in the appendices to now being the protagonist, and, you know, she just gets everything. But that's not what's really happening. And if you look at where we started with the Lord of the Rings movies, there were many women given very big positions of power and influence, and Eowyn herself, you know, then going into battle anyway. So I think that this matches well with how those characters were handled to finally give her a more fleshed out story. And then I think that the voice talent chosen with Gaia was perfect. I didn't actually realize that her mother is Emma Thompson.
No, I didn't either.
Yeah, because I was like, why does that name sound familiar? So that's how she became involved in acting. But yeah, I thought also she was just such a good fit for this and really makes it feel like she's another woman's voice you would hear that suits well along with the others like Eowyn. And even down to the naming of the character, you know, they made sure that in the background information, they said it's not related to Greek mythology of Hera. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Viking.
Yeah, I know. I think that was smart in that sense. You know, it is very, they gave it even the old English spelling. So I love that. You know, it's interesting because I don't necessarily, I actually don't have any issue with them doing this. I think that, you know, they took a character to which did exist, and yet didn't really have a part in the story. And they, I think they, for the most part, organically worked her into the story in a way that makes sense. You know, if she is this daughter that is being proposed marriage by, you know, this man who wants to kind of gain power, you know, Freka wants his son to Wolf to marry her to gain a foothold for the kingdom. You know, she is kind of the linchpin in the story, you know, because her father denying the request for her hand in marriage and everything. I mean, she is that. And so to make her a more active participant than in the story was really interesting. You know, I didn't necessarily, I wouldn't say that she is necessarily Mary Sue, because like you said, you know, we've seen characters, especially when you think of like Eowyn, who's really important to the story in Lord of the Rings. You know, she is the one who brings down the Witch King. In fact, the whole prophecy they didn't understand because they didn't realize it wasn't about just any man. It was about, yeah, it wasn't going to be a man. She's not a man.
She's a woman.
Sorry. Exactly. And so, you know, I think, you know, Tolkien himself, if he has even utilized women in ways that kind of broke the convention for, you know, the damsel in distress kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but I did sense in the movie that there were maybe too many times where male characters almost seemed helpless in the story and they needed the female character to kind of come in and save the day or come up with the plan as if they're the only ones who could. And that was, I think, there were points where it almost pushed it, I think, too far. I don't think it necessarily completely gets there, but I do think there are places where it gets pretty close.
Like with her brothers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting part of the story, and I think maybe this is an interesting time to kind of talk about this, is that with what's in the book, you know, it's one of her brothers does actually die defending Edoras as they leave, and then one of the other brothers is responsible for leading the people to the Hornburg, aka Helm's Deep, and then he actually is lost and then killed when he is sent out to raid during that long winter. And so both of the brothers do die like they do in the story. And then it turns out that it's the people of Gondor, as well as their cousin Freyluf, who is, you know, kind of responsible for saving them in the end. And so there's a lot of the story that is actually completely and legitimately the exact same, or that the big parts of the story are very similar, and yet they've definitely given this unnamed daughter, who the movie is named Hera, this role that gives her much more to do. And so I for the most part, I think it does work. And I didn't necessarily have a huge issue with it, because in the end, it doesn't really change the story in any way, in the sense that this story is really about, you know, the way in which we go from the first line of kings in Rohan to the second line. And so her being a part of the story doesn't actually change anything. In fact, the story still ends up the exact same place that it does, you know, in the appendice.
Okay.
And so I don't think that really changes all that much. You know, again, we just kind of give her more than just a mention of being an unnamed character. And, you know, like, I thought they did a great job with that. So you did mention the voice cast. So I think you mentioned that you really liked Gaia Wise as Hera. And I will mention that I actually felt like she might be the weak link for me in the voice cast. I didn't feel as invested in her performance as the voice. Just something about it just didn't feel as iconic. I almost wish that they had gotten somebody like Kerry Condon or somebody who has a slightly more distinct accented voice, you know, to be able to play her. You know, and I think part of that is because Brian Cox playing Helm Hammerhand is so recognizable.
Right.
And has such power behind it. Right. And I even felt like Lorraine Ashbourne, who's playing Olwen, you know, her handmaiden, was very good. And she just felt like, and I, maybe it was just that her voice came off as like, I needed maybe a slight more sense of maturity to her in the voice. And that might have helped. And so, you know, when you can't, when you're doing voice acting, I think the strength of the voice makes for the character. Whereas, you know, Miranda Otto as Eowyn, when that movie came out, you know, she was very young, obviously, and whatnot. But it's the strength of the performance fully from, you know, the her whole body acting in those scenes, you know, what she's doing with her eyes and her hands and everything in those scenes that really make it. You don't can't do that, obviously, in voice acting. It's only your voice. And so I just wasn't as struck by her in that part. But man, I thought Brian Cox was absolutely perfect as Helm Hammerhand, and he did a wonderful job. I thought that was an excellent choice for him, because again, he just has gravitas in his voice, and that's, you know, that's kind of a hard thing to pull off. Really, that's what you need in voice acting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so funny. I don't always remember just names, so I always have to go look and see their pictures again to remember who they are or where I know them from. But I always connect Brian Cox to the Bourne films. And
oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. He was the dirty one. So he's so good at, you know, giving a lot of weight and making a character memorable just by the voice alone. And so I think he was the perfect choice for Helm. And honestly, something I was so excited about was that I had heard, obviously, the term of Battle of Helm's Deep from the previous movies and everything, but hearing about how it got the name was cool.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And I think also, he really ultimately is the best of all of the voice cast on this movie. I think for me, Gaia was good. But I get what you're saying too, that maybe she was just too young at the time that this was recorded. Cause apparently she's only 25. And so I don't know, what age Liv Tyler was or, Miranda Otto at the time they did the films, but, they may have already been a little more mature and had a deeper voice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that makes complete sense. And so I think the strengths of the movie, you know, again, this is pulled straight from the appendices, and much of this film is very true to the way that the story is told in the appendices, which it's very brief in its story, and yet a lot of this comes straight from there. And like a lot of the stories in the Lord of the Rings series, and not just the Lord of the Rings itself, but its appendices, its the Silmarillion, and you know, so much other of the material that Tolkien had written. It's about the ways in which men can be destroyed by things like revenge, the lust for power, or pride. And I really liked the way in which, specifically something like pride, you know, it's seen in a variety of different ways. In somebody like Helm, whose pride, I think, lets him get into this fight with Freca, you know, and allows maybe his anger to take over, to hit him so hard it kills him. You know, we see the same type of pride in Wolf, whose pride makes him act incredibly foolishly. And you add that with the fact that he's so bent on revenge that he becomes completely reckless. He becomes someone without any honor. Freca being kind of just a great example of that lust for power and it making you do dumb things as well, right? Like trying to challenge the king. Then you did have Freyloth as a character who is their cousin, who becomes a great example of honor, as well as Helm's sons being also great examples of honor. And of course, you know, you see Hera as one as well. And so I just liked the way in which this movie really utilized the storytelling of Tolkien and the themes that were important to him, and really brought those out in all of these different characters. And I thought that they did a good job of portraying all of them in the way in which they can either destroy us or they can help us do the right thing and save others.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think you see that perfectly as well with Frailoff, where he and Wolf were sort of in similar positions, where Wolf had a decision to make when his father was accidentally killed and decided to lash out, whereas Frailoff was told by the king that he was an embarrassment and that he was banished, but instead he decided to take a beat to think about it and instead be respectful and go back and wait to see if he would be needed. So I loved his phrase as well, that, you know, I'll be there for the king when he needs me.
Regardless of whether he wants me to be or not.
Right. And so yeah. He shows that he's got honor and respect, even when he's told to his face that he's worthless and needs to be banished. Mm-hmm. So it does show that dichotomy of how different characters are handling a similar situation and what the right thing to do is. And I was really impressed.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. I thought that was one of the things that the movie did exceptionally well, in that it really took the themes that are in that story. And again, it's an incredibly short story in the appendices, and I think it brought them to life through all these characters in it. And it showed the way in which, you know, even a good character like Helm, right, can get caught in something like pride. And it can then, pride can become something that makes us make rash or kind of dumb decisions, which cost us either our lives or the lives of other people. I really, really appreciated that. And I thought it was really well done in that sense. And so, when you're doing Tolkien, Tolkien is very, you know, it's not hard when you're reading him to pick up the things that were important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really appreciate that they did a great job in that. And so,
I did have one other thing that, it wasn't in the outline, but that I thought of that was neat and kind of mentioned with the, explanation of how it became named Helm's Deep. I did like at the end as well the ties to introducing Saruman and actually behind the scenes they said that they used archive voice recording of Christopher Lee so that they wouldn't have to use a different actor and had gotten his wife's permission before she passed away this summer, apparently, to be able to do that. So it was great that they had the foresight to make sure that they got what they needed before she passed away as well, because I do think you absolutely need that. You can't have anyone else voice him at this point. And then also the mention about Gandalf.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. No, the connections. Oh, thank you for bringing that up, because I think you're absolutely right. I loved they did not use AI to help generate new Christopher Lee dialogue. They utilized dialogue that they'd already had from the recordings for the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films. And it's actual dialogue. It's not like they were feeding it into an AI machine to create new dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think that does make a huge difference. So I really appreciated that. I thought they did a great job with that. And so, and it did bring, you know, a lot to the film just to be able to hear his voice like that and know that that's really him. I also think that the way in which they did the connections to the Lord of the Rings series, it was good. And it doesn't take away from the story that they're telling here, but it felt organic and again, smart and well done. So I appreciated that. I thought that was good as well. So One of the keys to the Lord of the Rings films had been the music. Howard Shore creating the Lord of the Rings scores. And of course, he came back for The Hobbit as well. But he does not score this. It's Stephen Gallagher. And so I wanted to ask you how you felt that he did. He does bring some of the themes from Rohan that were done by Howard Shore into this movie, but then he does kind of create his own themes as well to run alongside that. And so did this, you know, stand up to the work that you would expect in a Lord of the Rings film after what we've gotten specifically in that series?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought that it fit well, and clearly, you know, he spent a lot of time researching and trying to implement some familiar pieces from the Lord of the Rings trilogy into what he did here. I think for me, it wasn't super memorable, but it did feel like it was authentic to Lord of the Rings and also to that Viking inspiration. You know, the type of instruments used to, they actually went to New Zealand and recorded with a symphony there to really make sure that this was something that would be worthy of the music from the Lord of the Rings. So I thought it was good, but not that I, you know, sit around going, man, I need to buy that soundtrack.
This is good. I think that Stephen did a good job. I liked the places, and of course, it only made sense that he would pull the themes of Rohan for this series. This movie, you have to, yes. And so, I like that. I do think that there are places where the score does lack, especially with the Lord of the Rings series and not the Hobbit series, just some of the dynamism that we became used to with the work that Shore did. But overall, it's a good score, and I think it does a good job of representing what you need here, which is you need it to represent Rohan, you need it to represent the Lord of the Rings series, and you also need to be able to service the film with the story you're telling.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they do a pretty good job. So I don't have any complaints there. And so all in all, Christy, I am really interested kind of where you fall then, you know, with your ratings for The War of the Rohirrim.
Well, I clearly, you know, had a lot of things to like about it. I think that the connections that we talked about to the source material were good. And, you know, definitely that I would go and see it again. Highly recommend everyone see it in Dolby. But I think that still it's good. It's just not great. So I give it a 3.5 out of 5 wedding dresses. Because I do think that there's a lot of interesting things here and something different and still feeling new, but familiar. And I think for sure they clearly paid attention with bringing in the right voice cast to give it that extra tie-in and make it feel important. And I think, like you said, lending more legitimacy to the animation style to not let that go away, because there are some stories that are just better suited to that. And frankly, I think that this was the easier way for them to get more box office sales than if they had tried to do another live action thing. Because it's never going to hold a candle to the original Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah, I also think that there's a big part of that where you know, you just talk about the cost to try and bring that to life. And an animated movie, in the end, is going to be so much less expensive.
Yeah.
And so I thought that it was great in that sense. And it's interesting you went with the 3.5, because that's exactly where I am with my rating. I think that this is a very good, solid movie. I think if anything, and it's not something that we did discuss, but I think the movie's probably 15 minutes too long. I do feel like you could probably have trimmed this down. It did not need to be the length that it was at. And you could have still told the same story, just a little bit more concisely. But on a whole, you know, I enjoyed this movie, and I'm looking forward to actually getting a chance to watch it again. And I think it's a really fun movie, and I hope people will go see it because, you know, I do like the idea of just kind of experimenting with animation and the storytelling here. And I think it was a good choice. And, you know, John and I have talked extensively on Aggressive Negotiations as well as here on the 602 Club that, you know, animation is a completely valid form of storytelling in film. And we need to stop pretending like it's not. And sometimes it's really just the better form of storytelling. And of course, it's a lot less expensive, you know, and you can still tell incredible stories. So I'm glad that they did this. And, you know, I would be interested, you know, I know they have other movies in the works, like The Hunt for Smeagol, I think is, or The Hunt for Gollum. And, you know, and that kind of thing. But, you know, Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion and whatnot are rife with and just chocked full of stories that you could tell incredible, you know, movies or TV shows or whatever. It just has to be done right. And it has to be done with respect for Tolkien. And I think for the most part, that's the thing that has helped, you know, at least the Lord of the Rings films work and this work is that you can tell that they do respect Tolkien. And you can see that. I mean, even if you read the behind the scenes stuff that I was reading for this, and even with the creation of the characterization for Hera. You know, they're looking specifically at references from Tolkien, and then from the time periods that Tolkien was taking, you know, inspiration from too. So yeah, this is great. But Christy, if people wanted to catch up with you, see what else is going on for you here as we hit the Christmas season, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter at Bespin Bell, and then sometimes over in the Babel Conference on Facebook. And I have a finished show that I did with my friends Amanda and Teresa called Sabers and Spells, if you want to check that out on the Skywalking Through Neverland Network. And what about you?
Yeah, you can find me all over the place on social media if I'm there. Just look for Matt Rushing 02. Of course, you can also find me here on the network with a lot of other shows talking a lot of Star Trek. Also over on the Nerd Party Network with the 602 Club, John Mills, talking about Star Wars each and every week. And then last but not least, completed show with Drea Kaufman called Owlposts. We discuss every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But thank you so much for joining us.
And y'all come back now, you hear?